And now we move on to a very interconnected point. If we're going to pray, then we're going to find a God of love. We're also going to find who we are. As all of you know, if you love anyone, you're going to discover a lot about yourself there. And it's not all going to be good or pleasing. But it's very important, isn't it, for all of us to know that if we're going to enter into prayer, say now, then God is loving me and you now. So God isn't loving me as I would have been if I had have had different parents, or if I hadn't have mucked up my teenage years, or if I hadn't ruined about 10 people's lives. This is not a general confession I am making. On the way through, it's not that far short of the truth, but it's not. So you see, God isn't loving you as you would like to have been, or as we might have been if, or if not. Well, that's not love. I mean, love has to be loving you as you are. So we're going to have a little sing-along in a minute. And for good or ill, it's going to be recorded. You ready? Come as you are, that's how I want you. Come as you are, feel quite at home. Close to my heart, loved and forgiven. Come as you are, why stand alone? No need to fear, love sets no limits. No need to fear, love never ends. Don't run away, shamed and disheartened. Rest in my love, trust me again. I came to call sinners, not just the virtuous. I came to bring peace, not to condemn. Each time you fail to live by my promise, why do you think I'd love you the less? Come as you are, that's how I love you. Come as you are, trust me again. Nothing can change the love that I bear you. All will be well, just come as you are. We won't like everything we see. For the real self, the self that is called to holiness, the self that is drawn into the communion of prayer, is not all beautiful. Not yet. We're weak, wounded people. Sin has polluted the environment in which we have had to learn to live. And we've given in to sin ourselves and added to the cosmic sludge. We've been hurt, and we've hurt others and ourselves. Even the good in us has its shadow side. Self-knowledge, therefore, is not always a pleasant thing. We can be inattentive to our real feelings and to our actual motivation. We can, even unwittingly, be acting in ways that are not truly coming from our heart or from grace. We can be doing what other people expect of us, or what we've come to expect of ourselves. We can live according to a pattern that we've learned, but it's not an expression of our real self. And it's not helpful to others, and it's not helpful to us. It's quite dysfunctional. Failure to know ourselves can lead to quite hurtful behaviour. But we can't avoid, if we're coming into prayer, we're going to have to find out about our real self. Knowing that we're loved, that's essential. As we are, but how are we? Who really are we now? Because we'll need to change, we'll need to grow, and love will purify us and all of that. John of the Cross has the image of a damp log put on a lovely winter fire. And it blackens and it hisses and the steam coming out of it and all the bits and pieces, and it's broken and pretty ugly. But if it stays there, if we leave it in the fire, after some time, all you've got left is beautiful, glowing coals. Fire. It's all been purified away. Whatever isn't fire is gone. So there's a lot of love in each of you and in me. There's a lot of not love. There's a lot of phony love. There's a lot of real self-knowledge, and there's a lot of dreaming, and there's a lot of unreality, and there's a lot of avoidance. How am I going? And there's a lot of pretense, and there's a lot, we've been hoodwinked since we were kids, told we were marvellous, and we still think we're marvellous, and no one loves us long enough to say, look, you're not good at this, kid, relax. Or whatever. So real self-knowledge we'll have to get, and we will get, as we look into the eyes of God. And what else is prayer? Keep in mind, it'll be beautiful, and it'll eventually show us something really wonderful in us. But we'll have to stay there and work through the hissing and the blackening and the purifying. A quite excellent author that I would highly recommend to you all is an English woman, Carmelite, probably in her late 60s now would be my guess, called Ruth Burroughs. She's written some 7 or 8 small books. I have found all of them quite excellent. And this is what she says in one of her books called Before the Living God. It seems to me, she says, that God has given me the grace to seek the truth and to stand in the truth. And essentially this means the truth about myself. Early in my spiritual life, she says, I was given a deep self-knowledge. This was to be the foundation upon which God wished to build. It forced me into the arms of His mercy. And in another work called The Ascent, meaning the climbing, the ascent to love, she says, almost always God's greatest gifts are wrapped up in the sacking of painful self-knowledge. Unless getting to know oneself really leads to a change of heart, she says elsewhere. And a more careful and conscientious fulfillment of one's obligations and a more selfless love for others, it's useless. You might trip off to the mountains and discover you're INFJ. Wonderful. I assure you it's the best thing to be because that's what I am, I'm told. They're all good, I know. You may discover you're number, I don't know, I haven't dared to do this one. You might be number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 on the Enneagram. You've got all this wonderful self-knowledge. And you're so on about yourself and you're so, you never wash and wipe up after yourself. You never think of caring for anybody else. You're living this, I mean, what the heck she's saying is all this self-knowledge. You don't know the slightest thing about yourself yet. So real self-knowledge is only going to be found actually in prayer finally. These can all help. But if they don't help us encounter the living God who alone loves us, and we only know ourselves through love, you know that. I have this wonderful memory, simple memory, but it's a wonderful one. I was very ill myself, psychologically ill in here, and I was resting on a Father's Day with a family back in Sydney, and this family with seven kids, the seventh had just been born, and the father was actually, he didn't know I was watching, I was just sitting back under the tree in the shade, feeling miserable about myself, but trying to enjoy the company. No, and I was just watching, and he was there, it had to be 10 minutes, but I didn't time it, but it was a long time, and he was just simply gazing into the eyes of this month, 6 week old baby. And the baby was just gazing back. That's all that was happening. But it went on for a long time, and I thought, what a beautiful thing to be happening. Because that little child was learning how wonderful she was, how beautiful she was, how worth contemplating she was. She wouldn't know it in her head, but who cares what's in the head? Often it doesn't. Her body knew that she was cherished, didn't it? That's how we learn we're loved, through the eyes of those who gaze at us with love. What a pity. I mean, what a pity we don't keep doing it all our life. Why do we stop when we turn to puberty or some blooming thing? Why don't we keep doing this, gazing at each other with love, like forever? How's this sounding? Why not? Adults are only babies in big bodies, really. So this, there's not much to us, is there? So you've got this, surely if we look into the eyes of Jesus, who incarnates God, we're going to discover lovingly, but really, who we really are. For good and ill, so that we can grow into who we're being called to become. John of the Cross warns us, if the warning is the right verb there, all the soul's infirmities are brought to light. If you're really praying and you're in contact with God, you can't hide. And the beautiful thing is to know you don't need to hide. You don't want to hide. You're beautiful. You're broken, hurting, sinful, mucked up. But that can all be straightened out and purified by love, because what God sees is something very beautiful. Give yourself a break. All the soul's infirmities are brought to light. They're set before its eyes to be felt, and we don't like that. I don't. And healed. If you don't feel them, you can't heal them. Now with the light and heat of the divine fire, the soul sees and feels these weaknesses and miseries which previously resided in it, but they were hidden and unfelt. And here's the image I thought of a moment ago. Just as the dampness of the log of wood was unknown till the fire was applied to it and made it sweat and smoke and sputter. That is what the flame does. The flame of love does to the imperfect soul. Here's a wonderful examination of conscience. Get ready. If you're blushing, I'll notice. John Henry Newman, maybe the greatest theologian of the 19th century, wonderful chaplain at the Oxford University, in one of his parochial and plain sermons. This is a summary that I've made of an 8-page sermon. He used to write his sermons, and they're very beautiful. They go for about 50 minutes, but I'm sure I would have sat right through them with delight. Well, this is my summary of his sermon on our secret faults. Check yourself by it. Many, he says, are content with such accidental information about themselves as the events of life force upon them. They neglect the duty of self-examination. We don't know who we are. To have only a slight acquaintance with one's heart is to have a superficial faith. Here's some questions he asks. Do I do good for praise? To avoid shame? For the satisfaction of being occupied? Am I blushing? I think I am a bit, because the third one is right on me. Get a crook feeling, so I go and prepare a lecture. No, just getting occupied is helpful, because you can avoid things, can't you, by being busy? Do you notice that? I'll tell you how to if you don't know how to do it. But he's not suggesting it's a good thing. Do I pray to God that he reveal my heart to me? Do you? Be suspicious, he says, of untested virtue, while remembering that we can fail even in areas where we've been found faithful. I remember the days with delight when I was, I'd say, a saint, an untested saint. Were you ever that? Go back a long way, some of us, but beware, he said, of untested virtue. Some of us, and I'd have to include myself here because of the life I led till I was 24, were sinless for sheer lack of opportunity. So, there is a danger, he says, of living a life of self-deceit, thinking far more comfortably of our spiritual state than is warranted. This is a brilliant little insight, I think. Self-love inclines us to hope for and presume the best. Not everyone's like this. Some presume the worst of themselves, and that is a real problem. But so's this, I assure you. There's a danger, especially when things are going smoothly and successfully. Then, he says, being content is mistaken for the peace of Christ. Natural affection is mistaken for Christian love. A natural energy is mistaken for zeal. Just one little attempt on my part for myself and for you to sharpen the question of the importance of self-knowledge. I'll now read to you from Teresa of Avila, the great woman, mystic, prayer. No one's written more beautifully about prayer, I imagine, than her, more thoroughly, perhaps I should say. And she has this to say. However high a state the soul may have attained, self-knowledge is incumbent upon it. And this it will never be able to neglect, even if it should so desire. Self-knowledge is so important that even if you were to be raised right up to the heavens, I should like you never to relax your cultivation of it. It's absurd, she says, to think that we can enter heaven without first entering our own souls, without getting to know ourselves and reflecting upon the wretchedness of our nature and what we owe God, and continually imploring his mercy. We begin the Eucharist, don't we, all the time with Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy. And we must mean it, but we'll only mean it if we know our own fragility and poverty. And these are beautiful things, these are not frightening things, these are lovely things to know. And need. Which brings me to perhaps the most important point to make, and I want you to check it for yourself if you think it's true. We don't get to know ourselves by looking at ourselves. That's the key. How can you? You can't pick yourself up by your own shoelaces. If I look at myself, I'm looking at myself with my own eyes which don't know myself. It's the blind leading the blind. I get to know myself by contemplating God, really, Jesus, you. But you contemplate not lost, to go back to the earlier beginnings of the first talk tonight. You don't get lost in the other, you're found in the other. You gaze into your mother's eyes, your spouse's eyes, your child's eyes, your parents' eyes, your confessor's eyes. We gaze into these eyes and we see reflected back who we are. And ultimately we're gazing into the eyes of Jesus, like the woman at the well who found out for the first time who she really was, through the innocent, still eyes of this lover, who showed her that she was just so capable of love and capable of having a spring of living water welling up in her. She never thought she had any of the foggiest chance of that. But he saw it and showed it, and he didn't pretend, so she saw it. And so it goes on and on all through the gospel stories. So that's a key here. If I try to get self-knowledge by introspection, I won't find myself. It has to be a loving contemplation of the other, but aware of the self, and, as it were, focusing on the other. I think this is true. Focusing on the other, but alert to who I am that is focusing. So we're meant to discover ourselves always in love. We're not meant to take notice of people who don't love us, who criticize us. We've got to protect ourselves from that. And sometimes it's our parents or are those closest to us we have to protect ourselves from, because they don't know us and we know they don't know us. And we have to be very gentle with ourselves. But if there's anyone in your life who loves you, whatever kind of word you're going to use for love and all the ranges of love, then hopefully that person will be true for with you, and you will learn from that person who's a sacrament of God for you. Because only if someone loves you, they know you. If they don't love you, they don't know you. So really, protect yourself. But if they love you, to that extent, they do know you, and they may help you know yourself. Teresa says, "We shall never succeed in knowing ourselves unless we seek to know God." I'll come back on that later. "Let us think of his greatness and then come back to our own baseness. If we turn from self towards God, our understanding and our will become nobler and more ready to embrace all that is good." You know what Jesus said, unless you become a little child, you can't even begin. So let's be a little child for the moment. those of you who have children will be able to do this readily. I suppose we all will be. But so you hold the child, be held. Now the child is needy, the child can't, little child can't think for itself, it can't get its own food, it can't protect itself, it's absolutely vulnerable. And if that's the only thing, let's say the child was able to think about all this, if that's the only thing the child could think about, it would be in a desperate, despairing situation. But for heaven's sake, the child at the moment that is all these things is actually in the mother's arms and fairly close to that wonderful place that produces all this wonderful stuff we call milk. So why not focus on that wonderful place and go giggle and go good, good, and just enjoy it? We are helpless, we are small, we are needy, we are children, we are not self-reliant. But we are in the arms of one who loves us. So what's the problem? We are expressions of God. What's the problem? We are fragile flowers in the field. But we're all expressing this wonderful mystery. So being fragile is actually a beautiful thing to be. It wouldn't be if we were alone, but we're not alone. Without me you can do nothing, said Jesus, but you're not without me. There's another lovely Catherine of Siena. Fourteenth century Italian young woman who was a beautiful woman of prayer. She says, as the soul comes to know herself, she also knows God better, for she sees how good he has been to her. In the gentle mirror of God, she sees her own dignity, that through no merit of hers, but by his creation, she is the image of God. And in the mirror of God's goodness, she sees as well her own unworthiness, the work of her own sin. For just as you can see better the blemish on your face when you look at yourself in a mirror, so that soul who in true self-knowledge rises up with desire to look at herself in the gentle mirror of God with the eye of understanding, sees all the more clearly her own defects because of the purity she sees in him. And here's Julian of Norwich again. So does our good Lord want us willingly to accuse ourselves and to see truly and know our falling and all the harms which come from it. Seeing and knowing that we can never repair it. He wants us also willingly and truly to see and know the everlasting love which he has for us and his plentiful mercy. To see and know both together by grace is the meek self-accusation which our good Lord asks from us. Do you feel the same gentleness in her writing that I do? It's just very truthful, but very gentle, very... I was reminded this morning of a memory, a fairly long ago memory now, nearly 30 years, I suppose, 25 years memory, but I might share it with you too. I was chaplain at the university and I was living with the students and renting houses and trying to help build community. And we moved into this house, which was in a terrible mess, because university students had been there before us and left it in a state that some teenagers tend to leave rooms. So it was a pretty messy place, and so it fell to me particularly because I was organising it to clean it up. And one of the things in this house that I'll never forget was a lamp, a standing lamp with a shade on it. And if you put the lamp on, you'd think you were in the stable somewhere. It was a filthy lampshade. It just blocked the light and was just, you couldn't, even I couldn't live with it, and I'm terribly unobservant, I noticed it, so it must have been terrible. So I decided I'd better look around, among the other things I was doing, for a second-hand lampshade, and I went thing, getting all the different things you need in a house, and I couldn't find a lampshade anywhere. And I came back that evening, and the woman next door, who knew what we were trying to do, in the meantime, probably having heard me complain about this, she'd done something about it. She'd taken this lampshade. It's still existing, by the way, this shade. It should be put somewhere in the archives of our order. And she'd cleaned it as far as one could, but very unsatisfactorily because it was uncleanable, but she got rid of some of the grime. And then, this is what I saw when I came home that evening, and the lamp was on, and I was presented with a lampshade. The black splodges that she couldn't get out were the centres for daisies. The dirty marks that were shapeless were garden paths working their way through this. I thought, holy smoke, it was like something you'd pay about $60 for nearly. She just painted it, painted around it. And I remember going into the room and having this very pious thought, you'll have to forgive me, I tend to get them. I thought, what a lovely image for sin and forgiveness. Because what we've done. It can't be undone. It can't be pretended away. It was done on whatever, whenever you did it. The mess was made, the deed was done, the evil goes on forever. You can't undo it. But God, who's even better than the woman next door, without putting her down, God can actually love it into something. And so that sin of St. Peter that he never forgot, denying Jesus three times, but he didn't remember it like introspectively despairing memory. What he remembered was the look of Jesus across the courtyard saying whatever Jesus' eyes were saying, and the Jesus he met on the lakeside who said, "Hey, Peter, do you love me?" And he asked him three times. You can get the connection without my helping you to do it. So sin here, yes, it's real, and it's to be remembered, and it's to be learnt from, and it's not to be repeated, and it's to be owned. But it can be graced, forgiven, and out of the forgiveness can come humility, compassion, tenderness, non-judgmental behaviour, all the things that each of us has learned because we've sinned and been helped through it. Back to Julian of Norwich. I saw most surely that it is quicker for us and easier to come to the knowledge of God than it is to know our own soul. For our soul is so deeply, beautiful insight, our soul is so deeply grounded in God and so endlessly treasured, we cannot come to knowledge of it until we first have knowledge of God, who's the Creator. Look, of course that's true. You can't know yourself unless you know God, because you are an expression of God. It's so obvious when you say it. But what a wonderful thing to say. Nevertheless, he says, I saw that we have naturally from our fullness to desire wisely and truly to know our own soul, through which we are taught to seek it where it is, and that is in God. Seek to know myself in God. That's prayer. Well, prayer is bigger than all that, of course, but all I'm trying to share with you tonight is if we want to actually pray, it's so important to know the kind of God we're going to find and to know from the beginning, I am going to discover who I really am, and I'll have to bear through the humiliation of that and the pain of it and the disappointment of it and the pruning and the fire of it if ever the true gold of my real self is going to be released from parental control, ego, and the rest of the stuff that we've all acquired from hurts and sin and living in a messy world. We've all acquired a whole lot of this stuff. We're only going to become saints when we're ourselves. You can't become a saint like anybody else. And you have to discover that beautiful self that you are will be, I imagine, always a fairly painful journey, but a purifying journey. And it'll be discovering myself, as she says, where I really am. In the arms, or if you prefer, gazed on by God. Loved by God. And so one final point before I perhaps have time to move into a couple of things on this general topic of self-knowledge. Teresa of Avila most wisely warns us against false self-knowledge and false humility. She says, I think it's wise anyhow, beware of certain kinds of, inverted commas, humility. And in her time it was normal to talk about the devil pretty readily, and I guess that's okay, as long as however mysterious the reality of evil is. Let's leave the words as they are here. Beware of certain kinds of humility which the devil inculcates in us and which makes us very uneasy about the gravity of our past sins. There are many ways in which he's accustomed to depress us. Everything such a person does appears to be dangerous, and all the service she renders, however good it may be, appears to her fruitless. She loses confidence and sits with her hands in her lap because she thinks she can't do anything well and that what is good in others is wrong in herself. That's not self-knowledge. That's not humility. Humility, she goes on to say, however deep it be, listen to this, it's so good, does not disquiet, trouble, or disturb the soul. If my soul is disturbed, and it often is, that's not humility. It's regret, it's hurtful thinking about myself, it may even be true, but I haven't come to humility yet, because humility brings immense joy. Well, she says it better. Humility is accompanied by peace, joy, and tranquility. Because humility is truth, that's all. The truth about who you are. And you are loved by God. Why wouldn't you be peaceful? Although on realizing how wicked we are, we can see clearly that we deserve to be in hell and are distressed by our sinfulness, if our humility is true, this distress is accompanied by an interior peace and joy. Far from disturbing or depressing the soul, it enlarges it and makes it fit to serve God better. Had I time, I would go on to make 5 points with you, but I will just touch on them and leave them for your later meditation. Self-knowledge, I suggest 5 things that you'll discover and I'll discover if we do it. Firstly, we're going to discover that we're creatures of God. That's the first thing to know. You are a ray from the sun. You're perfume from the flower that is God. You are an expression of the marvelous, creative love that we call God. That's a pretty good thing to find out. But that's what you are, uniquely. And I've suggested to you some texts there that Teresa says, for example, I can find nothing with which to compare the great beauty of a soul and its great capacity. The second thing you find out is that you're someone very dear to the heart of Jesus. those who love me, said Jesus, will keep my word, and my Father will love them and will come to them and make our home in them. Paul, you were bought with a price. Glorify God in your body. Good Christian stuff, incarnate stuff. Glorify in your body. It's no longer I, says Paul, who live, it's Christ living in me. Christ has made me his own. We are the aroma of Christ to God. The third thing we're going to find out is that we're temples of the Holy Spirit. Children of God, creatures of God, dear to the heart of Jesus, and we are a tabernacle, God's own secret hiding place, God's elected and very special garden that he likes to sit in, place where he likes to be, where he likes to walk in the evening, as with Adam and Eve in the garden. That's what I am, that's what you are. That's where God is, dwelling within us, loving to be there. I leave the texts for you to meditate on at your own leisure. Another thing you'll discover, two more final points to make. One is, spend time remembering all the ways in which God has graced you, because that's who you are. If ever you make a retreat of any length, and I hope you all have opportunities to do this, and there are opportunities well worth taking. One of the key things I think we all need to do often is go back and remember where we've been graced. Because we get busy and we can forget, and what a pity not to remember those precious moments. I gave you some of my memories tonight. You have your own. Remember those and hold them and taste them and relish them and let the, like you water a garden, let the gentle water seep right into your body and your and memory in that of how graced you've been, because that's where you'll discover who you are. And finally, as I've said all night, I guess, we'll need to discover our sinfulness and name it and be precise about naming it. Not just a vague sense of sinfulness, but actually know the ways in which we trip and pretend and confuse ourselves and others so that we can watch for it and know it in its reality, but always in the context of being graced and being loved by God. So that brings tonight to a conclusion. My hope and intention next week is to do two things with you should you wish to return. One is to say, okay, if we're going to enter into prayer with this God who dwells within us, discovering a God of love and finding out who we are, let's not do it alone. We don't have to do it alone. We're not meant to do it alone. We enter into prayer with Jesus. He takes us with him, into prayer. So I want to look at his prayer and how he invites us to share his prayer and how he actually prays in us. That will be the first talk next week. And then I want to have a look with you at the nature of holiness. So thank you.